Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined, as I often am, by Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you? Has your neighbour stopped smashing holes in the wall?
How's it, Nick? No, he has not. I thought somebody was knocking my door, but it was just the neighbour's workman banging on the wall next door, so...
So if you hear hammering, we'll try to mute our microphones and stuff, but if you hear bashing in the wall, it's not Marius losing it at the state of the country. It's actually just the neighbors renovating. And, of course, we also have Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm well. I must say, spectacularly renovation in my immediate vicinity free.
Fantastic. But
are you free of dogs dying?
Yes.
Yes. The dog didn't die. The dog threw up a bit. I think they probably heard the quality of my political analysis.
No, it wouldn't be the first time. Anyway.
Why did you say
there was one?
Like the dog. Is he gender? Is he, what do you call it? Non-binary.
I haven't asked him yet. It's his own right to make that decision. I'm not going to impose my heteronormative. What's it? Cis heteronormativity. On this creature. But I have to say that him throwing up behind me it reminded me of the time when he was just like a week or two old or something, and I was in a podcast with Nick and Sarah, and I could just see him urinating on my floor. And I must say, I was, like my floor, pretty pissed off.
What have you pissed off?
Well, I don't know. Okay, the point is, what I realized from that is, Herman, you're in trouble.
Let's reel it back in before this becomes a discussion about the minutiae of our lives. If you do enjoy the discussion of the minutiae of our lives, or you do enjoy us ranting about politics, please do like this video if you're on YouTube, subscribe to it, like our Facebook page. You know what to do. Just give us that sweet, sweet engagement, because we need it like dopamine. Anyway, let's get to our first story of today, which we weren't sure which one to make the first story, but I'm going to use my position as host to make it Road Rage on the Streets of Cabeja. Which I'm not pronouncing correctly, but for those of you who are not up to date with the times, that is PE. And this is one of those kind of Wild West South African stories that reminds you that we are very, very close to the edge of disorder. So police in the Eastern Cape are investigating a case of public violence and malicious damage to property after community members torched at least 10 vehicles during a violent protest. You think, okay, well, you know, that's bad, but that's not really particularly new for South Africa. Well, the causes of this seem to be quite new. According to a police spokesperson, Priscilla Naidu, it's alleged there was a motor vehicle accident between an Audi and a taxi. And a taxi driver got out of his vehicle and started to assault the driver of the Audi. The businessman of the area came to the assistance of the Audi driver, and the driver got out of into his vehicle and was then met by a group of taxi drivers who attacked him and set his vehicle alight. There was retaliation between the businessman and the taxi drivers. All in all, several shops were vandalized, two private vehicles were burned, and eight taxis were set on fire. The news report on this ends with the law enforcement officials are monitoring the area. Well, it would be nice if they were there a bit earlier, perhaps, to stop it. But anyway, I think it says something about the place that the country's in if a road rage incident between two people starts what is almost like a kind of gang turf war between local business people and taxi drivers. Herman, what should we draw from this, if anything, really? What bigger lessons do you think we could draw from this?
Well, the first thing is that, you know, Cabeja is apparently now being directed by Martin Scorsese. But the broader thing is that we should just be honest about what's going on here. Social harmony is historically proven to be dependent on socioeconomic progress and circumstances. And it doesn't take that, you don't have to look that far to find the evidence of this. If you look at the last 10 years, service delivery violence escalated by 440%, and you really can start to draw the line here between the social tensions emerging from the frustration that people are experiencing. And this real sad thing is how it is dividing societies that really don't need fuel on the fire in the first place. We are already dealing with a situation in South Africa where our history and our recent history, the last 10 or 15 years or so, cause enough distrust between ordinary South Africans, despite South Africans sharing priorities and interests, you know, all caring about education, corruption, and job creation. The real problem is that those areas of common ground get lost in these incidents where the triggers that usually are there in any society. I think road rage is a thing, but the moment you see these things become triggers for greater violence, it really is just an exacerbation or an escalation of the underlying societal tensions that are there. Combine that with the absolute joke that is the South African police service, and you've just got a recipe for absolute disaster. It's interesting that whenever the police are involved in something, they say they're monitoring the situation. It's just, yes, well, thank you for doing that. It is, we consider the situation thoroughly monitored, not managed, not diffused, not law and order restored. The situation is just monitored. And there is an interesting question here that we should, perhaps look at as a country with, you know, with regards to the police is, I think it's, you know, from the birth of modern policing under the premiership of, what was it, Edward Peel or someone in the UK, created the police force as something to not just follow up on crimes, but also patrol streets and be on the beat and prevent crime. And we should just really reconsider whether that sort of preemptive diffusory role of the police is something that we should expect to exist in South Africa. Clearly it isn't. I haven't seen any real evidence of that being systemically doable, but it really is tragic that the police can't prevent crime. They can't follow up on crime. So there really is a question as to what is their purpose at all.
I was explaining sort of how South Africa's police works to an American recently, and I said that in a lot of ways, unless there's a murder, basically, the South African police service exists as a bureaucratic step in order for you to get an insurance claim, which is,
yeah,
I think probably the best way to talk about it.
And it's not Morris, even a very effective bureaucratic step.
Yes. Morris, I must say that, you know, there's obviously, this is kind of the dark side of people doing it for themselves sort of thing. I suspect that the reason that these business owners decided to attack the taxis and burn them is because they said, these guys, they're basically the mafia, the police are scared to take them on, and if we don't go and take revenge personally ourselves, these guys are going to get away with acting like hooligans. I assume, you know, I don't know this for sure, but this is what I assume was the situation. What do you make of that kind of vigilante aspect? Do you think I'm right in guessing that that might have been what happened here?
I think so. I just want to quickly point something out. Everyone spoke about Edward Peel, who started British policing. It was Robert Peel, and that is what British police are called, bobbies, because from Robert.
Yes.
You know, as an aside, yeah, I think you're right, but this is also part of the broader breakdown in society. In a functioning country, in a country where the policing system works, this would obviously not have happened. You would have gone to the police and said, look, this is what happened. Would have been investigated, and if someone needs to be punished, they've got a fine, or, you know, maybe gone to court, whatever the case is. But I recently wrote Broken Blue Line 4 report, which is a report going back now nearly 10 years, looking at incidents of the police and organized crime and so on. And for the first time this year, we added a new section, which was looking at incidents of vigilantism. And there was so many of them, and it was often in poorer communities. And often when somebody was quoted, what the people would say is they simply can't rely on the police. They'll go and report an incident to the police, and the police won't do anything. If they do come, they'll just, you know, take a statement and bugger off and never come again. And so for a lot of these people, of course, you don't want to condone vigilantism. For a lot of these people, they feel they have to take the law into their own hands. And this is, you know, people on the margins of society or from poorer income areas. You know, people in the middle class are generally going to live in a probably going to have private security, probably going to live in a fairly well-secured house and so on. But for other people living in the areas where that's not possible, they've got to rely on their neighbors to, you know, if they go away for whatever the case is, they might not be able to afford decent security for their home. So this is the kind of thing that happens. And, you know, terrible things that also happen to petty thieves. You hear about somebody getting burned to death who stole a cell phone. You know, of course, you shouldn't be stealing cell phones, but you should not be getting a death penalty for stealing a cell phone either, especially dying in an awful way like being burned to death. But this is all a malaise. It just comes from the broader societal breakdown in South Africa. If the police worked, if the state was functional, we would not be seeing this kind of thing. And this is exactly why this happened in Port Elizabeth. Obviously, the foreign shop owners, whatever it was, feel like they can't rely on the police. The taxi drivers themselves also feel like they can't rely on the police. So, and now we're seeing a kind of a mini civil war down in the PEs. I mean, I saw some footage of Somalis walking, looked like high caliber automatic weapons. So it looked like it was Mogadishu, not even PE. So it's kind of scary. And, you know, I've also actually read that there's an issue with Somali gangs in London. Not because Somalis themselves are people who are attracted to violence or whatever cases, but there are people who've come from a place like Mogadishu and they had to rely on violence to survive. And they come to a place like London, they maybe don't get all the support they need and they fall back into, you know, the communities and, you know, gangs form and so on. And I don't think it's quite the same situation here in South Africa, but, you know, people have come from a place like Mogadishu. And while I think Joburgers think they're tough, I think you're from Mogadishu, I think you probably look tougher than the average Joburger.
Yeah, I think going toe-to-toe with Somalis on toughness, basically everyone in the world is gonna come short there.
So maybe Afghan, maybe.
Maybe, but even then, you know, Somalia has been doing the civil war thing for a very long time as well. They're up there with Afghanistan in, like, back-to-back worldwide civil war championships. Herman, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I hesitate to make this, you know, an abstraction or a thing about theory, but there might be a point here to be made on that score, is that there are a few theories of justice. You know, what is the point of the justice system? Is it retributive, as in to punish wrongdoers? Is it rehabilitative, to redeem and rehabilitate wrongdoers? Is it proportional, so that you you have these elements of the seriousness of the crime merits the seriousness of the punishment as a detriment or a deterrent future criminal activity? And one of the reasons why I think I am a classical liberal rather than perhaps more libertarian or anarcho-capitalist is that I do believe that justice left simply to mobs and communities really risks justice becoming just retributive. And it loses the element of rehabilitation, which I do think that if you have a general, you know, at least I get it from my Judeo-Christian moral background or wherever you choose to get it from, your humanitarianism or whatever. But I do think rehabilitation and is an important part of the justice system. And when the rule of law collapses, you absolutely lose that element of the law being an element for positive societal change. It really just then becomes about punishment and about deterring other criminal activities. But the problem with both of those are that they have no redemption, they have no real progress, they have no social cohesion, they have no hope really that they bring about. So when the rule of law collapses, when the statal rule of law collapses, some form of rule of law, of justice, will kick in. But the problem is it will always be more aggressive and less forgiving and procedurally likely unsound, because you won't have the presumption of innocence. So there will still be a form of justice, but it loses that constitutional, humane idea of you have the right to be protected, innocent until proven guilty, and even when you have been proven guilty, the justice system through its sentencing should give you a chance of rehabilitating yourself so that you as an individual could go back into your community. And that's the real fear here. That's why vigilantism is such a dangerous thing. Not because it replaces justice with just a more muscular form of justice. It replaces justice with a muscular, cruel and unforgiving and absolutely heartless, reckless, uncontrollable wildfire sort of justice. And if we are distrustful or disdainful of someone like Winnie Mandela for her role and in the mob justice of, you know, necklacing and so on, we should be very, very careful before we think that mob justice is just, you know, a sort of benevolent or morally neutral thing filling the vacuum of state failure.
And you guys said you wouldn't have anything to say on this topic in our pre-show discussions. Anyway, thank you, gentlemen, for that. I think that covers the topic well. Let's move on to one that I think we really won't have that much to say about, but it's kind of worth just talking about because of it's another one of these kind of cheap electioneering gimmicks. So, the City of Johannesburg City Power, which is currently run by the ANC, has issued a public statement asking Eskom to be excluded from stage 1 and 2 load shedding schedules. The people from City Power have said that they have just concluded a 2-year purchase agreement with Kelvin Power Station, which is one of the few privately owned power stations in the country. I think currently it's owned by Nedbank, I think I'm correct in saying. And they've agreed to purchase around 180 to 220 megawatts of power from the station for the next 2 years. So the acting CEO of City Power said, I therefore request that City Power be excluded from stage 1 and 2 load shedding as City Power has proactively made contingency plans to avert load shedding to its customers and businesses. There is some interesting background to this. Firstly, Kelvin Power Station actually used to belong to the City of Johannesburg, but was sold to private companies in 2001, and the city has decided for 20 years not to buy any power from it until just before an election. Secondly, according to the DA. I see someone in the comments asking who they're providing power to before now. I'm not actually sure. I think it may have been industry, some industry in the area. Although the power station, is, I know, has not been run at full capacity for a very long time because it's quite old. Anyway, the DA attacked it saying that it's not a permanent solution, firstly because it's only a 2-year agreement, secondly because it's not providing enough power, and thirdly because being an old power station, it's scheduled to be decommissioned in 2026. And so I wonder if it will have some of the same problems that our other old coal-fired power stations have across the country, which break down all the time. Maurice, what do you make of this? Am I being fair?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's such blatant electioneering. And, I mean, wow. I mean, how can they ask the Eskom to, you know, just stop load shedding to certain areas? I think what it's got to come down to is that people who use electricity need to start paying for it. Otherwise, we're going to have this issue going on into perpetuity. And it's never going to be solved, and it's going to be a problem. And, there's not much you can do until people are prepared to start paying for electricity. And that's what's got to happen. And there's been no, I mean, there's a legacy of non-payment of services going back to apartheid, which, you know, you can maybe say they were make an argument for that. But I think since 1994, obviously people who are from indigent households and so on need to get some sort of subsidy or exemption or whatever. But, I mean, I've said it before on the show. If you can afford to pay for your services, I think you need to pay for it. Otherwise, municipalities will continue collapsing and so on. And it's, yeah. That's also why we see increases in cost of services because some people aren't paying. And, this is something that other municipalities around the country are going to have to struggle with to get people to use services to pay for them. As I say, otherwise, it's going to be a problem that's not going to be solved for a long time.
Herman, I just find it funny that the ANC has been so lethargic about engaging with privately owned power stations and power providers and all that for the entirety of the load shedding debate. And suddenly, just before the election, oh, guys, we just realized that actually Cape Town had the right idea and we should probably buy from whatever source of electricity we have available.
Yeah, it's sort of beautiful in the sense that when their backs are really up against it, they go for free market
solutions. Sort of works. Right, it's proof that
democracy it's proof sometimes. That there's some form of accountability in democracy, at least, and some incentive to try and look like you're pleasing the voter. But I do think it is really ironic that even the socialist, blatantly command economy, anti-business, anti-free market ANC, when it wants to win votes, it proposes pro-business, free market, public-private partnership type of solutions. So it does show that these ideas are, even by the ANC in Gauteng, considered to have some traction. So, yay, that's a good thing from this whole story. But I must say that it is the whole problem with power, especially in parts of Soweto, is that these chickens are now seriously coming home to roost. It has been electorally and politically advantageous for the ANC not to, as it were, lean on to do the opposite on Eskom and municipalities, those responsible for, getting in the money for service delivery, especially electricity provision. It has been electorally and politically convenient for these people to be sort of ignored. And I remember a year ago, I think, a board member of Eskom blatantly said this in a parliamentary committee, that there was political pressure by government, by someone like, it might have been Pravin Gordhan, but I don't currently on that, who deliberately asked Eskom to go easy on non-paying ratepayers and municipalities for political purposes, so that you don't have, vast swathes of Soweto suddenly without power in an election year. So these things are really coming home to roost.
And I noticed with our recent bouts of load shedding that I may be wrong and I may be misremembering, so don't take me as too much of a prophet on this, but I'm pretty sure that we're doing less scheduled maintenance than normal on the electricity grid. And that suggests to me that there are many reasons that one might do less maintenance, but if you're trying to make sure there's as little load shedding as possible the lead up to an election.
But I think it tells you something that we are having load shedding 3 weeks before an election. That tells you, I think, how much trouble it's going to be. Because yeah, obviously that's like all the stops to not have any load shedding.
Yeah, I think there was like 15,000 megawatts of power offline or something due to unscheduled breakdowns, which is just crazy.
I think in the 2019 election, in the build-up there, there was massive reliance on Eskom diesel power generation. Ironically, or by happenstance, serendipitously, before the election, Eskom's diesel expenditure for diesel generation just went up to paper over the cracks in an election season. So, it's there are so many chickens coming home to roost. On so many levels, the fiscal debt on a national level, service delivery being now, or the service delivery, resources of so many municipalities being utterly depleted. And the fact that the ANC in this time of election, nearing, relies on essentially what is a DA solution, shows that a party with that sort of policy being sold properly could really benefit from the electoral benefits of saying, we've got a plan to end load shedding.
But there's too much money to be made in the other direction. Anyway, let us go forth to the next topic. And speaking of cheap electioneering gimmicks, Julius Malema has promised South Africans that they must have as many children as they want, have as many as 10 children, because don't worry, the state will feed them. Malema was speaking to a group of people in Emalahleni, in Mpumalanga, And he said that the youth of today were lazy because their grandparents had had as many as 10 children each. And this laziness must stop, and young people must reproduce and compete to match their parents, their grandparents and parents with many children. Because there were better circumstances because of taxpayer-funded social welfare. And then he said that any claim that there was no money to pay child support grants was incorrect. If the ANC can blow 500 billion rand on COVID-19 relief funds in 6 months, surely there was money for welfare. He basically said that, don't worry, guys, quote, you have SASA, which will help you through this problem. Anyway. He also promised that the EFF would make sure that all children were taken care of under an EFF government by granting them free education from grade 1 to 12 and then into university as well. So this is, shall we say, look, I said this before the show. I like people. I like more people. I am a pronatalist. But telling people that they should have more children because they can live off of welfare is not only, I think, dodgy on a moral level, but it's just a lie because there isn't money to pay for more people. The state is at its financial breaking point. It's madness. Homer.
Yeah, so I share your sentiments about that. I think there's very, 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 very little evidence, and the evidence there is flimsy, that big populations are problems. If that were the case, India and China wouldn't have shown economic growth over the same decades as they showed explosions in populations. Now, there are, of course, problems with nutrition, education, skills development, and all that. But the problem with South Africa is fundamentally that when the social grant system was introduced, we had more people in work than were on social grants, and that is now reversed. That we have more people on social grants than in work. And if you're going to try and get decreasing segment of your population to work hard enough to subsidize the lives of others, of people not in work, I think you're just, you know, setting the whole country up for disaster. And that's what there are many things to hate about the EFF, but this is one of them, is that they do make these promises knowing full well they will never have to keep them. They have no intention to actually keep them. There's no policy that can realistically do this. So it's morally irresponsible. But of course, what else do we expect from Julius Malema? The fact of the matter is, if you've got a growing population, that's not a problem. But the thing that needs to go with a growing population is growing value add economic activity. So that means if you are a citizen and you are one of 10 children, then you will be making a better contribution to this country by seeking the opportunities to deliver goods and products and services to others in your community in return for some sort of income. So population growth is not an economic negative. But population growth with no intention or on the excuse that you don't have to be a value add participant to the economy, that's when things get immensely dangerous.
Yeah, I think I'll push back a little bit. Population growth can be a problem, but it's exactly for the reason Aramon says. If you don't have people, if you don't have jobs for people and so on, and if you have a large number of young people, especially young men sitting around, if they're in the education, if they're not working, that is a very big contributor to instability. And that is a large reason why lots of African countries are unstable, is because you have lots of guys in their 20s and early 30s sitting around, nothing to do, and they don't actually want to go join the rebel group in the jungle or in the bush, whatever the case is, but nothing else to do. They get promised a square meal each day and a bit of fun and adventure, and they go and do it. So, and as you say, China, to a lesser degree, India have done pretty well from growing populations. That's because they've had economies growing at 5 or 6 or even more, 10% sometimes in India's case.
7%.
And South Africa doesn't have that at the moment. And but also at the same time, people having fewer babies is also a function of development. And generally, as a country develops, women get more access to job opportunities, to education. You can see it. It's a law as iron as the sun will rise in the east tomorrow. Years of education a woman has, the fewer children she's going to have.
It's,
and more job opportunities she has.
It's also, I think that there was a, the IRR put out a free fax recently, about how, while South Africa's population is probably around over 60 million now, our birth rates are declining quite significantly in accordance barely, with what's going on over the rest of the world. Yeah.
We are barely at above replacement level at the moment. So we are, our economy's not really going to shrink. It's going to stay at about 60 million if people on average have the same number of babies they have now. So just about 2 days average for a woman.
We shouldn't see from, you know, because development leads to lowered birth rates, therefore lowered birth rates would lead to development. We shouldn't make that logical fallacy.
So I
absolutely agree with you. In countries where there's high development, you've got lower birth rates. But that's not development because of lower birth rates. It's lower birth rates because of development. So the idea of getting 10 children, go for it, fine. I mean, if you want to do that, that's fine. But when it's done with this sort of rhetoric, with this sort of mendacious intent that Malema spews here from, you know, the rectum that is his mouth, I do think that is a destructive problem. Well,
the everything for free party is really living up to its name in this one. Let us call it to a close there. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful weekend. Please support the Institute of Race Relations. And yeah, we will see you next week for another episode of the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.